Listening Library presents Around the World in 80 Days by Jules Verne. Read for you by Jim Dale. Chapter 1, in which Phileas Fogg and Passepartout agree their relationship, that of master and servant. In the year 1872, the house at No. 7 Savile Row, Burlington Gardens, the house in which Sheridan died in 1814, was lived in by Phileas Fogg, Esquire, one of the oddest and most striking members of the Reform Club, even though he seemed determined to avoid doing anything that might draw attention to himself. And so one of the nation's most brilliant parliamentary speakers had been replaced by the enigmatic figure of Phileas Fogg, about whom nothing was known except that he was the most courteous of men and one of the most handsome gentlemen in English high society. People compared him to Byron because of his good looks, certainly not because of a limp, but a Byron with a moustache and whiskers, an impassive-looking Byron, who could have lived for 1,000 years without showing the signs of age. Though he was undoubtedly English, Phileas Fogg was not necessarily a Londoner. He had never been seen at the Stock Exchange or the Bank of England, or in any of the financial institutions of the city. No dock or basin in London had ever handled a ship whose owner was called Phileas Fogg. The gentleman in question did not figure on any list of board of directors. His name had never echoed through an inn of court, either the Temple, Lincoln's Inn, or Gray's Inn. He had never pleaded in the Court of Chancery, nor on the Queen's Bench, nor in the Court of Exchequer, nor in the Ecclesiastical Court. He was neither a factory owner, nor a businessman, nor a merchant, nor a landowner. He was not a member of the Royal Institution, nor of the London Institution, nor of the Artisan Club, nor of the Russell Institution, nor of the Literary Society of the West of England, nor of the Law Society, nor of the Combined Society for the Arts and Sciences, which enjoys the direct patronage of Her Gracious Majesty. He belonged to none of those numerous societies that proliferate in the English capital, from the Harmonic Society down to the Entomological Society, whose main purpose is the destruction of harmful insects. Phileas Fogg was a member of the Reform Club, and that was it. Anyone who may be surprised that a gentleman so shrouded in mystery should belong to this honourable association should realise that he had been admitted on the recommendation of Messrs. Baring Brothers, with whom he had an account. His financial standing was such that his cheques went through immediately, and his current account was always in credit. Was Phileas Fogg a wealthy man? There could be no doubt about that. But even the best-informed people were unable to say where his wealth came from, and Mr. Fogg was the last person they would have dared to ask directly. In any case, he was careful about money without being mean, since whenever a noble, useful, or generous cause was short of funds, he made up the amount required without making a fuss, without even giving his name. In a word, he was the most uncommunicative of gentlemen. He talked as little as possible, and this silence served only to increase his aura of mystery. Though he lived his life quite openly, he carried out his activities with such mathematical precision that it fueled other people's imagination. Was he well travelled? Quite probably, since he had a better knowledge than anyone else of world geography. There wasn't a single out-of-the-way place that he didn't seem to know in detail. Sometimes, by a brief but precise intervention, he corrected idle club speculation about travellers who had disappeared or got lost. He offered the most likely explanation of what had happened to them, and his words often seemed to be inspired by a second sight, since they were always borne out by events. Here was someone who must have travelled a lot. In his head, at any rate. What was beyond doubt, however, was that Phileas Fogg had not been outside London for many years. Those who had the privilege of knowing him better than most could confirm that the only sightings of him were as he walked each day from his house straight to his club. His only pastimes were reading the newspapers and playing whist. He often won when he played this silent game that was so well suited to his temperament, but his winnings never went into his own pocket. They made up instead a large part of what he gave to charity. It should also be noted that it was obvious that Mr. Fogg played for enjoyment and not to win. The game of whist was for him a combat, a struggle against difficulty, but a struggle that did not require him to go anywhere or travel around or tire himself out. And all that suited his temperament. As far as was known, Phileas Fogg didn't have a wife or children, something that can happen to the most respectable of people. But he had no relatives or friends either, which is less common. Phileas Fogg lived alone in his house in Savile Row and never let in visitors. The inside of his house was never mentioned. A single manservant was enough for his needs. He took lunch and dinner at the club like clockwork, always in the same dining room and at the same table. He never entertained his fellow members at table, never invited guests, and went back home only to sleep at exactly midnight, without ever making use of one of the comfortable bedrooms that the Reform Club makes available to its members. Out of every 24 hours, he spent 10 in his home, either sleeping or getting himself ready. When he went for a walk, it was always at a carefully measured pace and in the club's entrance hall with its inlaid wooden floor, or in the round gallery, above which rose a blue-stained glass dome supported by 20 Ionian columns in red porphyry. When he had lunch or dinner, it was the club's kitchens, larder and pantry, its fish store and dairy that supplied his table from their delicious reserves. It was the club's servants, solemn-looking figures dressed in black uniforms and wearing soft-soled shoes, who served the meal in special china and on the finest table linen. It was the club's cut glass, made to a one-off design that held his sherry, his port, or his claret, served with cinnamon and herbs. It was also the club's ice, brought at great expense from the lakes of North America, that kept his drinks chilled to just the right temperature. If this is what it means to be an eccentric, then it must be admitted that eccentricity has something to be said for it. The house in Savile Row, without being luxurious, could be considered extremely comfortable. In any case, because the habits of its occupant never varied, serving him was a simple matter. However, Phileas Fogg required his only servant to be extremely punctual and reliable. On that particular day, the 2nd of October, Phileas Fogg had dismissed James Forster, as the fellow had committed the crime of bringing him his water for shaving at a temperature of 84 degrees Fahrenheit instead of 86, and he was waiting for his replacement, who was due to arrive between 11 o'clock and 11:30. Phileas Fogg, firmly ensconced in his armchair, with his feet close together like those of a soldier on parade, with his hands on his knees, his back straight and his head raised, was watching the hands of the clock move forward. It was a complicated piece of machinery that showed the hour, the minute, the day, the month, and the year. On the stroke of 11:30, Mr. Fogg was due, according to his daily routine, to leave the house and go to the Reform Club. Just at that moment there was a knock on the door of the small drawing-room in which Phileas Fogg was sitting. James Forster, the manservant who had just been dismissed, appeared.
"The new servant," he said.
A man aged about 30 presented himself and bowed.
"You are French, and your name is John?" Phileas Fogg asked him.
"Jean, if you please, sir,"
replied the new arrival.
"Jean Passepartout, a nickname that has stuck and that I earned by my natural ability to get myself out of tricky situations. I consider myself to be a decent fellow, sir, but to be quite honest with you, I've had several different jobs. I was a travelling singer, a horse rider in a circus, a trapeze artist, and a tightrope walker. Then I became a gymnastics instructor in order to put my talents to more practical use, and most recently I was a fireman in Paris. I've even been on the scene of some famous fires in my time. But 5 years ago, I left France, and since then, because I wanted to live with the family, I've been a manservant in England. However, when I found myself without a position, and when I learned that Mr. Phileas Fogg was the most precise and most stay-at-home person in the United Kingdom, I came to Sir's house in the hope of being able to lead a quiet life and put behind me everything associated with Passepartout, even the name.
Passepartout suits me, replied the gentleman. You have been recommended to me. I have good reports of you. Do you know my terms?
Yes, sir.
Good. What time do you make it?
11:22.
Replied Passepartout, as he took out from the depths of his waistcoat pocket an enormous silver watch. "Your watch is slow," said Mr. Fogg.
Oh, "Forgive me, sir, but that is impossible."
"Your watch is 4 minutes slow. It's not important. All that matters is to note the difference in time. So from this moment onwards, 11:29 on the morning of the 2nd of October, 1872, you are working for me." With that, Phileas Fogg got to his feet, took his hat in his left hand, put it on his head with the precision of clockwork, and disappeared without saying another word. Passepartout heard the front door close a first time. It was his master going out. Then it closed a second time. It was his predecessor, James Forster, leaving in turn. Passepartout was now alone in the house in Savile Row. Chapter 2, where Passepartout is convinced that he has at long last found his ideal.
"In all honesty,"
Passepartout said to himself, somewhat bemused to begin with,
"I've encountered wax figures in Madame Tussaud's with more life about them than my new master."
During the brief opportunity he had just had of seeing Phileas Fogg, Passepartout had quickly but carefully observed his future master. He was a man of perhaps 40, with fine and noble features, tall of stature if slightly portly, with fair hair and whiskers, a smooth forehead with no sign of wrinkles around the temples, a complexion that was pale rather than full of colour, and magnificent teeth. He seemed the very embodiment of what the physiognomists call stillness in the midst of agitation, a quality common to all those who prefer action to words. Calm, phlegmatic, with clear eyes and a firm gaze, he was the perfect example of the cool-headed Englishman, a type commonly encountered in England, and one that the paintings of Angelica Kaufmann have captured perfectly in rather a formal pose. As he went about his daily business, the gentleman gave the impression of something perfectly calibrated and finely balanced, like a chronometer made by a master craftsman. Phileas Fogg was indeed the paragon of precision, as could be seen from the expressiveness of his feet and hands, since in human beings as well as in animals, the limbs are themselves a means of expressing feelings. Phileas Fogg was a person of mathematical preciseness, someone who was never rushed but always ready, always economical in his movements. He never took an unnecessary stride and always chose the shortest route. He never allowed himself to be distracted. He was careful never to make a superfluous gesture. He had never been known to be upset or disturbed. He was the least hurried person in the world, but he always arrived on time. However, it is easy to understand why he lived alone and without any social relationships. He knew that everyday life involved social contact, and because such contact took up time, he chose to live without it. As for Jean, who was known as Passepartout, he was a Parisian through and through. During the 5 years he had spent in England working as a manservant in London, he had looked in vain for a master who he could devote himself to. Passepartout was not one of those cheeky or scheming servants who strut about trying to be clever and cocky. On the contrary, he was a good chap with a friendly face and prominent lips that were made for eating, drinking, and kissing. He was a kind and helpful soul, with just the type of roundish head that you'd like to see on a friend's shoulders. He had blue eyes, a bright complexion, a plump face and puffy cheeks, a broad chest, a thick waist, powerful muscles, and an immense strength, further developed by plenty of exercise during his youth. His brown hair was rather unruly. If the sculptors of antiquity knew 18 different ways of arranging Minerva's tresses, Passepartout knew only one way of doing his hair, dragging a comb through it 3 times. Whether someone of his extrovert nature would get on with a person like Phileas Fogg was too early to say. Would Passepartout be the sort of servant, precise as clockwork, that his master needed? Only time would tell. After having had an adventurous youth, as has been seen, all he wanted was a quiet life. Having heard people sing the praises of the methodical nature of the English and the proverbial coldness of their gentlemen, he had come to England in search of fortune. But so far luck had not been on his side. He had not been able to settle down anywhere. He had worked in 10 different households. In every one, the people had been temperamental or unpredictable, eager to seek out adventure or explore other countries, something that no longer suited Passepartout. His most recent master, the young Lord Longsferry, a member of Parliament, regularly needed to be helped back home by policemen after his late nights out on the town. Since what Passepartout wanted most was a master he could look up to, he ventured some polite observations, but they were not appreciated, and so he left. He discovered in the meanwhile that Phileas Fogg Esquire was looking for a servant. He made some inquiries about this gentleman. Someone whose daily life was so well ordered, someone who never spent the night away from home and didn't travel or even go away for a day, was bound to suit him. He went along to his house and was taken on in the circumstances already outlined. And so, as 11:30 struck, Passepartout found himself alone in the house in Savile Row. He immediately began to look around. He inspected it from top to bottom. The house was clean and tidy, austere and puritanical, and well planned for servants. He liked it. For him it was like being inside the shell of a snail, but a snail that had gas lighting and heating. Coal gas supplied, in fact, all that was needed for heating and lighting. Passepartout had no difficulty in finding the second floor bedroom that was to be his. It pleased him. Electric bells and speaking tubes made it possible to communicate with the suites of rooms on the ground and first floors. On the mantelpiece, an electric clock matched the clock in Phileas Fogg's bedroom, and both instruments showed exactly the same time, down to the last second.
"This really suits me down to the ground," Passepartout said to himself.
He also noticed in the bedroom a piece of paper above the clock. It set out the daily routine for domestic service. It contained, from 8 o'clock in the morning, the set time when Phileas Fogg got up, until 11:30, the time when he left for lunch in the Reform Club, all the details of domestic service. Tea and toast at 8:23, water for shaving at 9:37, doing the master's hair at 9:40, etc. Then from 11:30 in the morning until midnight, the time when this methodically minded gentleman went to bed, everything was written down, planned out, and taken care of. Passepartout was overjoyed to contemplate this timetable and to commit every detail to memory. As for the gentleman's wardrobe, it was very extensive and carefully thought out. Each pair of trousers, each jacket or waistcoat, carried a roll number that was also recorded in a logbook, showing the date when the items of clothing, according to the time of the year, were to be worn in rotation. The same system applied to the shoes. In a word, this house in Savile Row, which must have been a monument to disorder in the time of the famous but dissolute Sheridan, was comfortably furnished, a sure sign of considerable wealth. Mr. Fogg didn't have a library or books. They were unnecessary since the Reform Club gave him access to 2 libraries, one for literature and the other for law and politics. In the bedroom there was a medium-sized safe, built to withstand both fire and theft. There were no firearms in the house, no hunting guns or weapons of war. Everything indicated peaceful pursuits. After examining the residence in detail, Passepartout rubbed his hands in glee. His broad face was beaming, and he repeated joyfully,
"This suits me down to the ground. It's just what I wanted. Mr. Fogg and I will get on famously. A home-loving and well-ordered man. Oh, someone who functions like clockwork. Well, I'm not sorry in the least to be working for someone who functions like clockwork."
Chapter 3, in which Phileas Fogg becomes involved in a conversation that could prove costly to him. Phileas Fogg had left his home in Savile Row at 11:30, and, after putting his right foot in front of his left foot 575 times, and his left foot in front of his right foot 576 times, he reached the Reform Club, a huge building in Pall Mall that had cost no less than £120,000 to construct. Phileas Fogg went immediately to the dining room, with its nine windows opening onto an attractive garden with trees that had already turned an autumn brown. There he sat down at his usual table where his place was already set. His lunch consisted of a starter, followed by poached fish, served with a first-rate Reading sauce, a blood-red steak accompanied by mushroom ketchup, a rhubarb and gooseberry pie, and a slice of Cheshire cheese, all of which was washed down by several cups of tea, an excellent variety that had been specially picked for the pantry of the Reform Club. At 7:47, the gentleman got up and walked over to the main drawing room, a magnificent place decorated with richly framed paintings. There, a servant handed him an uncut copy of The Times, which Phileas Fogg proceeded to carefully unfold with a skillfulness that demonstrated a considerable familiarity with this delicate operation. Phileas Fogg continued reading this newspaper until 3:45, following it with The Standard, which took him up to dinner. This meal followed the same pattern as lunch, except for the addition of Royal British Sauce. At 5:40, the gentleman appeared again in the main drawing room and engrossed himself in the Morning Chronicle. 30 minutes later, various members of the Reform Club came in and went up to the fireplace, where a blazing coal fire was burning. They were Mr. Phileas Fogg's usual partners, fanatical whist players like him: the engineer, Andrew Stewart, the bankers, John Sullivan and Samuel Fallentin, the brewer, Thomas Flanagan, and Gauthier Ralph, one of the directors of the Bank of England, all wealthy and distinguished figures, even for a club whose members included the leading lights in industry and banking.
"So, Ralph," inquired Thomas Flanagan, "what's the latest on this business of the robbery?"
"Well," replied Andrew Stewart, "the bank isn't going to get its money back."
"On the contrary," said Gauthier Ralph, "I hope that we will be able to get our hands on the criminal. Police detectives, the best in the business, have been sent to America and Europe, to all the main ports of entry and exit, and it will be extremely difficult for this person to escape them."
"So you have the description of the thief, do you?" asked Andrew Stewart.
"In the first place, he's not a thief," Gauthier Ralph replied in all seriousness.
"What, you don't call someone who's got away with £55,000 in banknotes a thief?"
"No,"
replied Gauthier Ralph.
"So he's a businessman, is he?" said John Sullivan. "The Morning Chronicle tells us that he's a gentleman."
The person who gave this reply was none other than Phileas Fogg, whose head emerged at that point from behind a pile of paper surrounding him. At the same time, Phileas Fogg greeted his colleagues, who greeted him in turn. The incident under discussion, which was a subject of heated debate in the various British newspapers, had occurred 3 days earlier on the 29th of September. A wad of banknotes amounting to the enormous sum of £55,000 had been taken from the desk of the principal cashier of the Bank of England. To anyone who expressed surprise that such a theft could have taken place so easily, the Deputy Governor, Gauthier Ralph, merely replied that at that moment the cashier was busy recording a taking of 3 shillings and sixpence, and that he couldn't keep an eye on everything.
But it should be pointed out here, and this makes what happens somewhat easier to explain, that this admirable institution called the Bank of England seems to be extremely concerned for the dignity of the public. There are no guards, no former soldiers, and no grills. Gold, silver, and banknotes are on open display at the mercy, so to speak, of all comers. It would be unthinkable to question the honesty of any member of the public. One of the keenest observers of English society even recounts the following anecdote. One day when he happened to be in one of the rooms in the bank, he was eager to have a close-up view of a gold ingot, weighing between 7 and 8 pounds, which was lying on the cashier's desk for all to see. He picked up the ingot, examined it, handed it to the person next to him, who in turn passed it on, the result being that the gold bar went down to the end of the dark corridor, only to come back to its original place half an hour later, without the cashier even looking up. But on the 29th of September, things didn't quite turn out the same way. The wad of banknotes did not come back, and when the magnificent clock above the cash desk struck 5 o'clock, closing time, all the Bank of England could do was to register in its accounts a loss of £55,000. Once the theft had been duly reported, police detectives, the pick of the profession, were dispatched to the main ports, Liverpool, Glasgow, Le Havre, Suez, Brindisi, and New York, with a promise of a reward of £2,000 plus 5% of the amount recovered if they were successful. While waiting for the results of the investigation that had got underway immediately, the inspectors were given the task of keeping a careful eye on all passengers entering or leaving these ports. As it happened, just as the Morning Chronicle claimed, there was reason to believe that the person responsible for the theft was not a member of the criminal fraternity. During that day of the 29th of September, a well-dressed, well-mannered, and distinguished-looking gentleman had been noticed pacing around in the cash room, the scene of the crime. The investigation had made it possible to put together quite an accurate description of the gentleman, and it had then been sent immediately to every detective in the United Kingdom and on the continent. Some wise souls, and Galthia Ralph was one of them, therefore felt justified in thinking that the thief would not get away. As can well be imagined, this incident was on everyone's lips in London and the whole country. It was the subject of heated debate, with differing opinions on the chances of success for the Metropolitan Police. It should come as no surprise, then, to hear the members of the Reform Club discussing the same issue, especially as one of the bank's deputy governors was among their number. The highly respected Galthia Ralph had no intention of doubting the success of the police investigation, since he considered that the reward on offer should act as a considerable incentive to the energy and competence of the police. But his colleague Andrew Stewart was far from being so confident, and so the discussion continued between these gentlemen as they sat at the whist table, Stewart partnering Flanagan and Fallentin partnering Phileas Fogg. During the game, the players didn't speak, but between the rubbers the conversation resumed, more lively than before.
"I maintain," said Andrew Stewart, "that the thief is likely to get away with it, since he's bound to be a smart individual."
"Come off it," replied Ralph. "There isn't a single country where he can hide."
"What are you talking about?"
"Where do you expect him to go?"
"I've no idea," replied Andrew Stewart. "But after all, the world's a big place."
"That used to be true," said Phileas Fogg quietly. Then he added, "It's your turn to cut, sir," showing the cards to Thomas Flanagan. The discussion was broken off during the rubber, but soon Andrew Stewart brought the subject up again.
"What do you mean, used to be true? Has the earth got smaller, by any chance?"
"Certainly," replied Galthia Ralph. "I agree with Mr. Fogg. The earth has got smaller because you can now travel around it 10 times as quickly as 100 years ago. And in relation to this particular case, that's what will speed up the police inquiries.
And that's what will make it easier for the thief to escape as well."
"Your turn to play, Mr. Stewart," said Phileas Fogg. But the sceptical Stuart was not convinced, and when the game was over, he added,
"I must admit, Ralph, that you've got a funny way of saying that the world has become smaller, just because you can now go around the world in 3 months."
"In a mere 80 days," said Phileas Fogg.
"Quite right, dear sirs," added John Sullivan. 80 days since the opening of the section between Rothal and Allahabad on the Indian Peninsula Railway. This is how the Morning Chronicle worked it out. From London to Suez via the Mont-Cenis Tunnel and Brindisi by railway and steamship, 7 days. From Suez to Bombay by steamship, 13 days. From Bombay to Calcutta by railway, 3 days. From Calcutta to Hong Kong by steamship, 13 days. From Hong Kong to Yokohama, Japan, by steamship, 6 days. From Yokohama to San Francisco by steamship, 22 days. From San Francisco to New York by railroad, 7 days. From New York to London by steamship and railway, 9 days. Total, 80 days.
"Yes, 80 days, exclaimed Andrew Stuart, accidentally trumping a winning card. "But that doesn't take account of bad weather, adverse winds, shipwrecks, derailments, etc."
"It does include them," replied Phileas Fogg while continuing to play, because by now the whist was taking second place to the discussion.
"Even if the natives of India or North America take up the rails," exclaimed Andrew Stuart, "even if they stop the trains, ransack the wagons, and scalp the travellers?"
"Including all that," replied Phileas Fogg, laying out his hand and adding, "two winning trumps." Andrew Stuart, whose turn it was to deal, picked up the cards and said,
"In theory you're right, Mr. Fogg, but in practice?"
"In practice too, Mr. Stuart."
"I'd like to see you prove it."
"That depends only on you. Let's do it together."
"Heaven forbid!" exclaimed Stuart. "But I'm quite prepared to bet £4,000 that such a journey undertaken in these circumstances is impossible."
"Quite possible, on the contrary," replied Mr. Fogg.
"Well, try it then."
"To go around the world in 80 days?
"Yes."
"I'm quite prepared to."
"When?"
"Straight away."
"This is madness!" exclaimed Andrew Stuart, who was beginning to get annoyed at his partner's persistence. "Come on, let's get back to the game."
"Deal the cards again, then," replied Phileas Fogg, "because there's been a misdeal." Andrew Stuart's hands trembled as he took back the cards, and then he suddenly put them down on the table, saying,
"Well, all right, Mr. Fogg, all right. I'll bet £4,000. "My dear Stuart," said Fallentin, "calm down. You must be joking." "When I talk about betting," replied Andrew Stuart, "I'm never joking."
"I accept," said Mr. Fogg. Then he turned towards his colleagues. "I have £20,000 deposited with Baring Brothers. I'm quite prepared to risk them."
£20,000, exclaimed John Sullivan. £20,000 that you could lose as a result of an unexpected delay?
"There's no such thing as the unexpected," was all Phileas Fogg said in reply.
"But, Mr. Fogg, this period of 80 days is calculated only as the minimum time."
"A minimum put to good use is enough for anything."
"But in order not to exceed it, you have to change with mathematical precision from railway to steamship, and from steamship to railway."
"I will do it with mathematical precision."
"You must be joking."
"A true Englishman never jokes about something as serious as a bet," replied Phileas Fogg. "I bet £20,000 against anyone that I will go around the world in 80 days or less. In other words, 1,920 hours, or 115,200 minutes. Do you accept?
We do,
replied Messrs. Stewart, Fallentin, Sullivan, Flanagan, and Ralph, after agreeing among themselves.
Good, said Mr. Fogg. The Dover train leaves at 8:45. I shall be on it.
On it tonight?
Asked Stewart.
Yes, tonight, replied Phileas Fogg.
So, he added as he consulted a pocket calendar, since today is Wednesday the 2nd of October, I must be back in London in this very drawing room in the Reform Club on Saturday the 21st of December at 8:45 in the evening. Otherwise, the £20,000 now in my account with Baring Brothers will legally be yours to share. Here's a cheque for the same amount. The terms of the bet were drawn up and signed on the spot by the six parties concerned. Phileas Fogg remained calm and collected. He had certainly not made the bet in order to win money, and he had only committed these £20,000, half of his fortune, because he expected to have to spend the other half on carrying out this difficult, not to say impossible, mission. His opponents, for their part, seemed uncomfortable, not because of the amount of money at stake, but because they felt embarrassed about the one-sidedness of the arrangement. 7 o'clock then struck. They offered Mr. Fogg the possibility of stopping the game to enable him to prepare his departure.
I'm always ready, replied this impassive gentleman, and, handing out the cards, he said, Diamonds or trumps? Your turn, Mr. Stewart.
Chapter 4, in which Phileas Fogg takes his servant Passepartout completely by surprise. At 7:25, after winning about 20 guineas at whist, Phileas Fogg said goodbye to his distinguished colleagues and left the Reform Club. At 7:50, he opened the door of his house and went inside. Passepartout, who had been conscientiously studying his work schedule, was quite surprised to see Mr. Fogg appear at this unusual hour, committing such an error of timing. According to what was written down, the occupant of Savile Row was not due to return until exactly midnight. Phileas Fogg first went up to his bedroom, then called out, Passepartout! Passepartout did not reply. The call couldn't possibly be for him. It wasn't the right time. Passepartout, Mr. Fogg repeated without raising his voice. Passepartout appeared.
That's the second time I've called you, said Mr. Fogg.
But it's not midnight yet, replied Passepartout with his watch in his hand.
I know, replied Phileas Fogg, and I'm not criticizing you. In 10 minutes, we leave for Dover and Calais.
A puzzled sort of expression appeared on the Frenchman's roundish face. It was obvious that he had misheard.
Is Sir off somewhere? He asked.
Yes, replied Phileas Fogg. We are going around the world.
With his staring eyes, raised eyelids and eyebrows, limp arms and slumped body, Passepartout at that moment displayed all the symptoms of surprise bordering on stupefaction.
Around the world? He muttered.
In 80 days, replied Mr. Fogg. So we don't have a moment to spare.
But what about the suitcases?
Said Passepartout, whose head was rocking involuntarily from right to left.
No suitcases, just an overnight bag. In it, 2 woolen shirts and 3 pairs of socks. The same for you. We can buy things on the journey. Bring down my raincoat and my travel rug. Get some sturdy shoes. In any case, we won't be doing a lot of walking. Off you go.
Passepartout would have liked to respond. He was unable to do so. He left Mr. Fogg's bedroom, went up to his own, and collapsed into a chair. Lapsing into a colloquialism, he said to himself,
Well, that takes the biscuit, just when I was looking forward to a quiet life.
And so, like an automaton, he got ready to leave. Around the world in 80 days? Was he dealing with a madman? No, it was a joke. They were going to Dover. Fair enough. To Calais, fine. After all, that was nothing for the dear fellow to get upset about when he hadn't set foot in France for 5 years. Perhaps they would get as far as Paris, and, to be honest, he would be pleased to see the great capital city again. But certainly a gentleman who was so careful not to take one step too many would go no further than that. Yes, that was it, quite probably. But it was also a fact that this gentleman, who up to then had been so much of a stay-at-home, was about to set off to get on the move. By 8 o'clock, Passepartout had prepared the smallish bag containing his and his master's clothes. Then, still feeling at a loss, he left his room, carefully closed the door, and rejoined Mr. Fogg. Mr. Fogg was ready. He was carrying under his arm Bradshaw's Continental Railway Steam Transit and General Guide, which was to give him all the information needed for his journey. He took the bag from Passepartout, opened it, and slipped into it a thick wad of those splendid banknotes that are legal tender all over the world. "Have you forgotten anything?" he asked.
"Nothing, sir."
"My raincoat and my rug?"
"Here they are."
"Good. Take this bag." Mr. Fogg handed the bag to Passepartout. "Be careful with it. There are £20,000 inside." Passepartout almost let go of the bag as if the £20,000 had been in gold and too heavy to carry. Master and servant then went downstairs and they double-locked the front door behind them. There was a carriage rank at the far end of Savile Row. Phileas Fogg and his servant got into a cab which drove quickly to Charing Cross Station, the terminus for one of the branch lines of the South Eastern Railway. At 8:20, the cab stopped in front of the railings of the station. Passepartout jumped down, his master followed and paid the coachman. At that moment a poor beggar woman with a child in her hands, barefoot in the mud, wearing a tattered shawl over her rags and a battered hat, decorated with a pathetic-looking feather, went up to Phileas Fogg, asking for charity. Mr. Fogg took out of his pocket the 20 guineas he had just won at whist, and, as he gave them to the beggar woman, said, "Take this, my poor woman. I'm glad to have met you." Then he went on. Passepartout felt as if tears were coming to his eyes. His master had made an impression on his heart. Mr. Fogg and he immediately went into the main hall of the station. There Phileas Fogg told Passepartout to buy 2 first-class tickets for Paris. Then, as he turned around, he noticed his 5 fellow members of the Reform Club. "Gentlemen, I'm on my way," he said, "and the various stamps in the passport I'm taking for this very purpose will enable you to check where I have been when I get back."
"Oh, Mr. Fogg," replied Gauthier Ralph politely, "that's not necessary. We will rely on your word as a gentleman."
"I prefer it this way," said Mr. Fogg.
"You won't forget, will you, that you must be back?"
remarked Andrew Stewart. "In 80 days, replied Mr. Fogg. "By Saturday, 21st of December, 1872, at 8:45 in the evening. Goodbye, gentlemen." At 8:40, Phileas Fogg and his servant took their places in the same compartment. At 8:45, the whistle blew and the train set off. It was pitch dark, and it was drizzling with rain. Phileas Fogg, sitting in his corner, didn't say a word. Passepartout, still in a state of shock, was clinging onto the bag of banknotes like an automaton. But the train had got no further than Sydenham when Passepartout let out a real cry of despair. "What's the matter?" asked Mr. Fogg.
"What's the matter is, in the rush, my state of confusion, I forgot—"
"What?"
"To switch off the gas lamp in my bedroom."
"Well, my dear fellow," Phileas Fogg replied coldly, "you'll be paying the bill." Chapter 5, in which a new type of share appears on the London market. When he left London, Phileas Fogg could have had little idea of the impact that his departure would have.
The news of the bet first went around the Reform Club and had a considerable effect on the members of that distinguished institution. Then, from the club, its effect spread to the newspapers via reporters, and from the newspapers to the public in London and the whole United Kingdom. This issue of the journey around the world was discussed, argued about, and analyzed with as much passion and energy as if it had been a major international dispute like the Alabama claim. Some people sided with Phileas Fogg. Others, and they were soon in the majority, came out against him. To go around the world, other than in theory and on paper, in such a short time, and with the means of transport currently available, was not only impossible, it was madness. The Times, the Standard, the Evening Star, the Morning Chronicle, and a dozen other newspapers with a wide circulation came out against Mr. Fogg. Only the Daily Telegraph supported him up to a point. Phileas Fogg was in general considered an obsessive and a madman, and his fellow members of the Reform Club were criticized for having accepted this bet, which was evidence of a decline in the mental capacities of the person who had made it. Some extremely heated but well-argued articles were published on the subject. It is well known how seriously anything involving geography is taken in England. And so there was not a single reader, regardless of social class, who failed to devour the columns devoted to the case of Phileas Fogg. In the early days, some independent-minded people, mainly women, were for him, especially when the Illustrated London News published his portrait, based on a photograph from the archives of the Reform Club. Some gentlemen went as far as to say, well, why not after all? Stranger things have happened. They were mainly readers of the Daily Telegraph, but it soon became clear that even the support of this newspaper was beginning to wane. In the event, a long article appeared on the 7th of October in The Proceedings of the Royal Geographical Society. It examined the question from every perspective and proved conclusively the madness of the undertaking. According to this article, everything was against the traveller, human obstacles and natural ones. For the plan to succeed would require a miraculous coordination of departure and arrival times, a coordination that didn't exist and that couldn't exist. At a pinch, and in Europe, where the length of the journey was relatively short, the trains could be expected to arrive on time, but when they take 3 days to cross India and 7 to cross the United States, how could anyone consider them reliable factors in such a calculation? And with mechanical breakdowns, derailments, encounters with the unexpected, bad weather, heavy snow, surely everything was against Phileas Fogg. On steamers, were you not, in winter, at the mercy of gusts of wind or patches of fog? Was it that unusual for the fastest transatlantic ships to be 2 or 3 days late? Yet all it needed was one single hold-up for the whole chain of communication to be irreparably broken. If Phileas Fogg missed a steamer by only a few hours, he would be forced to wait until the next steamer, and that would be fateful for his whole journey. The article had a considerable impact. It was reprinted in almost all the newspapers, and shares in Phileas Fogg fell considerably. During the early days after the gentleman's departure, there had been some heavy betting on the risks involved. It is well known that in England, betting is an activity practiced by a more intelligent and select group of people than gambling. Betting is part of the English character. So not only did various members of the Reform Club place considerable bets for or against Phileas Fogg, but the public as a whole followed suit. Phileas Fogg was treated like a racehorse, entered in a sort of form book. He was also made into a new sort of share that was immediately quoted on the London market. There were buying and selling prices for Phileas Fogg, and large amounts of money changed hands. But 5 days after his departure, after the article in the Proceedings of the Royal Geographical Society, people began to sell. Shares in Phileas Fogg fell. There was a wave of selling. Quoted first at 5 to 1, then 10, the odds then became 20, 50, and 100 to 1. He had only one supporter left. This was the elderly, paralysed Lord Albemarle, The noble sir, confined to a wheelchair, would have given his whole fortune to go around the world, even if it took him 10 years. So he was the one who bet £5,000 on Phileas Fogg. And when people showed him not only how foolish the plan was, but also how pointless, he merely replied,
"If it can be done at all, then it's only right that an Englishman should be the first to do it."
This, then, was the situation. The supporters of Phileas Fogg were becoming fewer and fewer. Everyone, and not without reason, was turning against him. The odds were now 150, 200 to 1. Then, 7 days after he had left, something quite unexpected resulted in no odds being given at all. What happened was that during that day, at 9 o'clock in the evening, the commissioner of the Metropolitan Police had received the following telegraph message. To Rowan, Commissioner, Police Headquarters, Scotland Yard, London, from Fix, Detective Inspector, Suez. Trailing bank robber, Phileas Fogg. Send arrest warrant without delay, Bombay, British India. The effect of this telegram was immediate. For honourable gentleman, people now read bank robber. His photograph, which was kept in the Reform Club along with those of all his fellow members, was carefully examined. It reproduced down to the last detail the features of the man whose description had been provided by the police investigation. People remembered how secretive an existence Phileas Fogg led, how solitary he was, how sudden his departure had been, and it seemed obvious that by inventing this story of a journey around the world and then backing it up with an absurd bet, this individual had acted with the sole intention of putting the British police force off his scent. Chapter 6, in which the detective Fix shows a quite understandable impatience. The circumstances leading up to the sending of this telegram about that man Phileas Fogg were as follows. On Wednesday, the 9th of October, the liner Mongolia was due to arrive in Suez at 11 o'clock in the morning. The Mongolia, which belonged to the Peninsular and Oriental Steam Navigation Company, was an iron-hulled, propeller-driven steamer with a spar deck. It weighed 2,800 tons and had a nominal 500 horsepower. The Mongolia regularly did the run from Brindisi to Bombay via the Suez Canal. It was one of the company's fastest vessels, and it had always exceeded its scheduled speed, namely 10 miles per hour between Brindisi and Suez, and 9.53 miles per hour between Suez and Bombay. While they waited for the Mongolia to arrive, two men were walking along the quayside, mingling with the crowd of natives and foreigners that flocked to this town, which was until recently only a village, but which can look forward to a successful future thanks to Ferdinand de Lesseps' great feat of engineering. Of these two men, one was the United Kingdom consul based in Suez, who, despite the pessimistic forecasts of the British government and the bleak predictions of Stevenson, the famous engineer, saw British ships going through the canal every day, thereby reducing by half the journey from England to India compared to the old route via the Cape of Good Hope. The other was a small, skinny man, quite intelligent-looking but nervous, with an almost permanent frown on his face. His long eyelashes concealed a piercing gaze, but one that he could soften at will. At that particular moment, he was showing signs of some impatience, pacing up and down, unable to stay still. This man was called Fix, and he was one of those English detectives or policemen who had been sent to the various ports after the discovery of the theft at the Bank of England. Fix was supposed to keep a careful watch on passengers travelling via Suez, and, if one of them aroused his suspicions, to stay on his track until he received an arrest warrant. As it happened, 2 days previously, Fix had received the description of the suspected thief from the head of the Metropolitan Police. It was a description of that distinguished, well-dressed gentleman who had been seen in the cash room in the Bank of England. The detective, obviously spurred on by the prospect of a large reward for a successful arrest, was therefore waiting for the Mongolia to arrive with understandable impatience.
"Am I right, sir?" he asked for the umpteenth time, "that according to you the ship must be in soon?"
"Yes, Mr. Fix," replied the consul. "It was reported yesterday as being off Port Said, and a vessel as fast as this will get through the 100 miles of canal in next to no time. I should remind you again that the Mongolia has always earned the £25 bonus that the government gives every time a ship arrives 24 hours ahead of schedule."
"The ship's coming straight from Brindisi, isn't it?" asked Fix.
"Yes, straight from Brindisi, where it picked up the mail for India. It left Brindisi on Saturday at 5 o'clock in the evening, so be patient. It must be in very soon now. But I really don't understand how, with the description you've got, you'll be able to recognize your man if he really is on board the Mongolia."
"My dear sir," replied Fix, "you sniff out this sort of individual rather than recognize them. It's nose that you need, and nose is like an extra sense, a combination of hearing, sight, and smell. In my lifetime, I've arrested more than one of these gentlemen, and as long as my thief really is on board, I can guarantee you that he won't slip through my fingers."
"I hope not, Mr. Fix, because it was a substantial theft."
"A magnificent theft,"
the detective replied enthusiastically.
£55,000! We don't often get such big windfalls. Thieves are becoming petty criminals. The great English thief is a dying breed. People get themselves hanged for only a few shillings these days."
"Mr. Fix," replied the consul, "the way you talk, I wish you every success, but I must repeat that given the circumstances, I'm afraid your task will not be an easy one. You must realize that from the description you've received, the thief is a perfectly respectable-looking person."
"My dear consul," the police inspector replied in a dogmatic tone of voice, "great thieves always look like respectable people. You must understand that people who look like crooks have only one option, to remain on the right side of the law, otherwise they would be arrested. It's the honest-looking faces you have to examine closely. A difficult task, I admit, and one that makes this not just a job, but an art."
It is clear that the aforesaid Fix had a strong sense of his own importance. Meanwhile, the quayside was gradually getting busy. Sailors of different nationalities, shopkeepers, brokers, porters, and fellers were flooding in. The liner was obviously about to arrive. The weather was fairly good, but the air was chilly because of an easterly wind. Some minarets stood out above the town in the pale sunshine. Towards the south, a jetty about 2,000 meters long stuck out like an arm into the harbour of Suez. Several fishing boats or coastal vessels moved across the surface of the Red Sea, some of them still having the elegant outline of an ancient galley. As he made his way through this crowd, Fix ran a rapid eye over the passers-by out of sheer professional habit. By now, it was 10:30.
"But this liner doesn't look as if it's ever going to arrive,"
he exclaimed as he heard the harbour clock strike.
"It can't be far away," replied the consul.
"How long will it stop in Suez for?" Fix asked.
4 hours, the time needed to take on board more coal. From Suez to Aden, at the far end of the Red Sea, it's 1,310 nautical miles, so it needs to have a fresh supply of fuel."
"And from Suez, does the boat go straight on to Bombay?" asked Fix.
"Straight on, without unloading."
"Well then," said Fix, "if the thief is coming this way and on this boat, it must be part of his plan to disembark at Suez in order to find another way of getting to the Dutch or French possessions in Asia. He must be well aware that he wouldn't be safe in India, which is British soil."
"Unless he's a very clever man," replied the consul. "As you know, an English criminal is always better off hiding in London rather than abroad."
After this remark, which gave the detective food for thought, the consul went back to his office, which was only a short distance away. The police inspector remained alone, an impatient bag of nerves. He had a strange sort of premonition that the thief was bound to be on board the Mongolia, and in all truth, if the crook had left England with the intention of reaching the New World, it would be logical for him to prefer the route via India, because it was less carefully watched, or more difficult.